If you're wondering why the sound only seems to be coming kind of from the sides and not from the front, it's because we're having some problems with the main system today, so that's kind of why. But if it helps, I can speak really loud from the front to make it seem like it's all surrounded. But today, actually, following on very well from praying for at least the persecution Christians around the world, we're going to be talking a little today about one of the kingdom values called courage. And I'm going to go through three stories in the Bible about some acts of courage. And we're going to look and think about it and explore a little bit more. And the first one I'm going to start with is David and Goliath. And I think it's pretty good because we normally don't preach too much on David and Goliath in grown-up services because we easily relegate that to a children's story. But I want to talk a little bit about, and I want to read a little bit from the passage. But before then, the main thing that I want to get across for this part is that courage comes when you know what you stand for. If you know what you are fighting for, what you believe in, that's when courage appears. If you don't know what to stand for, you will never demonstrate courage. I mean, that's what we're going to look at a little bit today. And so starting off with 1 Samuel, it starts off here. And this is Goliath. And so let me summarize to you. The two armies, Philistine has actually come to attack Israel, and they've lined up on the outer side of the battlefield. And so normally what happens is they're squared off. Battles don't just suddenly happen because it takes a long time for the troops to get there, and they amass all the troops first, and then the other side amasses their, well, they're trying to defend, and they all get everyone ready. And here in this case, there's a big giant or a behemoth, someone they say is much taller than everybody else, and he's fearsome, and he's wearing this heavy armor, and they're describing it actually in the first few verses, all the kind of armor that he's wearing and the sword. So he's kind of fearsome, imposing character. And he comes out, and he's basically taunting the Israelites. And so he says, he stood and shouted to the ranks of Israel, "Why have you come out to draw up for battle? Am I not a Philistine? And are you not servants of Saul? Choose a man for yourself and let him come down to me. If he is able to fight with me and kill me, then we will be your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you shall be our servants and serve us." And the Philistine said, "I defy the ranks of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together." When Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. All right, so this is a big deal because actually one of the key things they say here is Saul and the Israelites. Now, Saul was the king. He was anointed, and he was the king of Israel at this time. And actually, in this kind of battle for the Israelites, what he's supposed to do is Saul is actually supposed to go out and fight this giant. He's supposed to fight Goliath. So this is what's supposed to happen. But obviously, Saul is like, "I'm not going to fight him because I'm going to get killed. I'm not going to do that. That's a dumb thing to do. So I'm going to hide away." So they're all kind of scared. And so this goes on for a little bit. And you get the sense like, okay, well, they're kind of squaring off. And at some point, you realize there's going to be a battle. Now, your question is, why are they doing this? Why don't they just go straight to battle? Well, because if you put out your strongest warrior, threaten them first, you actually don't lose so many men in battle. So if you have someone like Goliath on in your army and you bring him out to battle and you taunt, you know, these people, you can say, "Well, look, let's do this. Let's sell it this way." There's kind of an impasse. No one comes down and sits up and sets up a negotiation table and say, "Let's discuss this. How are we going to do this?" There's going to be a fight at some point. Now, one of the things I want to highlight here is, what does Goliath say? And the Philistine said, "Oh, does this have a laser, right? Oh, it doesn't. I defy the ranks of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together." Actually, but for there, "Am I not a Philistine? And are you not servants of Saul?" Now, I want to highlight this first because it's pointing out two things. One, Goliath, the Philistines, they don't acknowledge God or the God of the Israelites at all. To them, these are just servants of Saul. These are just Israelite people, dogs ready to be killed to the slaughter. Let's go on. So what happens is all the men of Israel, when they saw the man, fled from him and were very much afraid. And the men of Israel said, "Have you seen this man who has come up? Surely he has come up to defy Israel. And the king will enrich the man who kills him with great riches and will give him his daughter and make his father's house free in Israel." All right, so they're saying, "Look, this guy is going to come and kill us, and if we could fight and we could stop him, you know, this is probably the deal for Goliath's side and also for our side. If someone kills him, then he'll get anything, right?" And what does David? So David is the youngest at this time. He's already been anointed by Solomon. He's the future king, though nobody knows it, except for David and his family. David, this time, well, he's still a shepherd. He's out there protecting the sheep. And his dad says, bring some food to your brothers who are out there. So there's already been, they've called in all the people who are ready to fight and say, look, let's get ready for this battle. So his father says, David, go bring some food to your brothers. And David shows up there. And he goes there and he looks and he hears this Philistine call out and shout. And it's like, you know, come on, you servants of Saul, come out and fight. David hears this, and this is his response. And David said to the men who stood by him, what shall be done for the man who kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach of Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? And the people answer him the same way, so shall it be done to the man who kills him. In other words, all the people are thinking, look, anyone who kills this Goliath, you're going to get everything from the king. You'll get the king's daughter. You'll get a land. You know, that's the promise that's there. David's question is actually rhetorical. He doesn't care about the treasure or the reward. His whole point is, why are we letting this Philistine tear down the name of God? See, David doesn't lose sight of this whole thing. We talked a little bit about this last week, where David, even as king, always knew that God is king above all other kings. Here in this case, David is saying, look, how can you let this guy degrade or tear down the fact that we are the armies of the living God? Never at any point does David lose sight that the God he believes in is living and true. There is no doubt for him about this. This is important because you immediately draw a distinction between the way the Philistine looks at these people and what David thinks about the people himself. For David, he understands the Israelites, they are God's people. God is there with them. God is the one who led them. God is the king. Who can counter God himself? So the passage goes on. And David goes to King Saul and says, hey, I will go and take down this guy. You know, I'm willing. And they're looking at him like, and actually King Saul says, you are just a boy. How can you go out and fight this man? And David's response is this. Your servant has struck down both lions and bears, and this uncircumcised Philistine shall be like one of them, for he has defied the armies of the living God. Once again, David's line is clear. Look, this guy does not know God. He is saying that our God is not true and not real. If he defeats us, it's like saying our God doesn't exist. If we lose to the Philistines, then we might as well say our God is weaker than their God. How can we accept that? How can we allow that? This person is threatening us. He's threatening, actually, the truth about God. And so I stand up to defend. I stand up for the honor of God. And then he says, of course, I've killed lions and bears. This guy is no different. Now, this is very important, okay? Because when I was a kid, I listened to this story and thought, oh, yeah, this is amazing. A small person beats a big person. I took great joy and pride and hope in that and ran away from all battles that came my way. But this here, David understands, look, he's killed lions and bears. As a shepherd, he has to protect his flock. So you have to understand, well, how do you kill a lion or a bear? Well, you could do as they say in the Man's Handbook to Survival. Make yourself look bigger so the bear gets scared and it runs away. You could try to bop it in its nose or something, and then you're like, okay, well, I have very low chance of doing that. Maybe if you have a sword, you could kind of fight it and a shield. But to be honest, if a lion is going after you, if you have a sword, that lion is already too close, right? If a lion jumps at you, if a bear gets at you, and you have a sword, you have to be chopping an awful lot to kill this beast. You cannot, right? Because at that point, once a lion has its claws and is jawing you, that sword is useless. Because you go, ow, and you'll drop the sword. You have all the armor. That will protect you for, you know, 5-10 minutes at most. So David understands this because he's looking at this scenario the same way. Look, I've killed lions and bears, probably with my same little slingshot, but all you need is good aim, a really fast rock, and good targeting, right? And so he thinks that, and he says, but above all, look, I know that God is with me, and so I will stand up and defend his honor. So, of course, you get this whole picture laid out because then David says, the King Saul says, I give you my armor and my sword. And there's this really funny kind of story where he puts it all on and he looks in and says, I can't go out like this. This is untested for me. So let me just go down to the stream, get 5 stones and my slingshot. Or sling. not an Angry Bird slingshot, by the way. I also like to point out, he only takes 5 stones because if you're David and you have run out of 5 stones, it's probably too late, okay? You probably only need 5. In reality, he's probably got 3 good shots in before Goliath is on top of him. So he looks and says, well, might as well just get 5 and let's go with this. But his confidence is still like, well, I know God is with me. So let's come and look at this. This is the key part because now you have the dialogue between Goliath and David. Because Goliath actually looks at him and he laughs at him and says, you come at me with your dog? And then David says this, you come to me with sword and with a spear and with a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hand, and I will strike you down and cut off your head. And I will give the dead bodies of the host of the Philistines this day to the birds of the air and to the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. And that all this assembly may know that the Lord saves, not with sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hand. Oh my goodness, that is so powerful. Do you understand why David says this? Because he believes it to his core that God is God of everything. And when he comes out here and he stands out here in front of David and Goliath, and we stand in front of Goliath and we say, oh, it's such courage. He has that courage because he never loses sight of who he is defending. His courage is found in the fact that, look, I defend God's honor because he is the Lord of hosts and nothing's going to stop him. By an earthly standard, you will look at this and say, David's a fool. You know, why is he going out there? You know, that doesn't make any sense. But for him, it's, there is no other option. When someone is slandering or harassing or attacking you, you stand up. And especially in this case, it's not for himself. When someone is attacking God, he stands up to defend. And not just that. This whole thing. Do you ever have the confidence or the audacity to proclaim with such confidence that this is our God? I don't know about you, but like if someone came in and said, oh, you believe in God? You're stupid. I don't believe any God. Clearly Darwin was right. You know, I'm a Dawkins follower. Or I follow this. Would you have the boldness that you come at me with your Dawkins and your Darwin? You come at me with your evolution? Disregarding the fact that actually we don't know what happens before then. But I come at you with the name of the Lord, God of the armies of Israel, the God who created all of this and all this intellect that you might have, consciousness itself, and you defy it. So obviously you would say, Bert, that's so aggressive. Okay, maybe not about the aggression, but that faith, that confidence. If you don't have confidence that God is true, then you will have no courage to stand up for him. And if you have no courage, you have to ask yourself, why not? And when that boils down to it, it comes down to, where is my relationship with God? How much do I know him? You start realizing that actually this courage to stand up isn't about yourself or your knowledge or your intellect or your ability or your power, although those things can come into play. It's actually about your relationship with God himself, your love for him, your love to him. So you know what happens in this story. Obviously, Goliath comes out, laughs. David takes a stone. He has a very good aim. He's killed lions. He knows the threat. He swings it around. And it lands and hits him square in the head and knocks him dead. All right, so for the most part, my wife said, do you think it really killed him? I said, if not, throwing a stone that hard to someone's head will render him unconscious. The next thing David does guarantees that they kill him because he takes the sword and cuts off his head. He's not getting up after that. All you have to do is actually render him unconscious, and then you have a chance, right? So you look at it that way, you say, oh, this story actually now makes a lot of sense. It's very believable. In fact, in some ways, it's only the only way it could have unfolded, because you bring out another warrior out there with a sword, Goliath's reach is too long, isn't it? His armor's too big. You're going to be in trouble. You got to use a distance range attack. They didn't have guns back there, so this is the closest thing you're going to get. So on a mental level, you say, oh, that's great. But if you peel it back to the spiritual level, you understand, actually, this courage, this boldness. Courage will stand up for what is worth defending. You will have courage when there is something that is worth defending. Now, it's funny because we see this a lot of time nowadays, especially online. Someone can make some critical comment about your football team, your favorite kind of restaurant, your favorite computing system. You'll say something and someone will immediately write back, that's stupid, you're just a follower, or your team sucks. They immediately stand up to defend. Of course, this is a lot easier when everything's anonymous and you're not really defending anything, but you're hiding behind a curtain, sitting in the sofa, eating your food. You're easy to defend in that case. But you have to ask yourself, you know, what do you stand for? Where is your heart or your courage rooted in? If you never display any courage, it just means that you don't have anything to stand up for. We're going to look at a second story now. You're in luck, all of them are from the Old Testament today. We're going to look at Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Now, these are... Now, by the way, if you want to really do Bible studies and think about stuff, look at Daniel. Look at the time the Israelites are in exile. Because this is fascinating stuff. This is crucial for us today because actually we're similar. We're actually living in some ways, exile. We're living in a culture that's different than ours. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, these three were taken away. So at this point, the Babylonian Empire comes in. They take down the Israel nation. And what they do is... they take the people, and they bring them back. Okay, so this is one of the ways, if you ever want to conquest a nation, you have to figure out, what do we do with the people there? Do we leave them there? If you leave them there, there's a chance they could rise up and revolt against you. Problematic. If you take them away, then you have to deal with refugees and resettlement. So one of the things the Babylonians did, what did they do? They went in, killed people, showed them by their force of their power and their bronze. Then they took the smartest people. Took all the smart people and said, okay, all you smart people, come here. We are now going to indoctrinate you. We're going to teach you everything about Babylon, about what it means to be Babylonian. All our magicians, all our teachers, we're going to put you through the best education systems. So at the end of this, you are trained the best, but you love us. You become like us. Your thinking is like ours. And that's the best way to do it. So that's their mentality. That's their strategy. So they took these great people. They took these really smart people. And the ones we know about, in particular in the Bible, are Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Now, we're going to look a little bit further. And the point here is, courage is part of your kingdom identity. It's not just a value. It's who you are. So if you know who you are, where your kingdom is, then that's where courage is going to come out. So we're going to look at this passage and look at Daniel chapter 3. Now, here in this passage, the king at the time, King Nebuchadnezzar, which I love saying, I think it's a great name. Anything with so many Zs must be a winner, like ZZ Top. Anyways, King Nebuchadnezzar is here, and he's saying, so back then, you have to understand, if you are a king or an emperor or ruler, you are also a god, okay? Whoever is the highest, you say, I have this power because I am a god, okay? That's what it was like for many, many, many years, and depending on the U.S. election, it might also continue. We have here, and they say, hey, King Nebuchadnezzar, why don't you make yourself a giant statue, and every time we play these musical instruments, everyone has to bow down. Now, they did this partially because they saw Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and they knew those guys did not bow down to any other gods. So they wanted to trap them. Your typical political underdealing, your workplace, you know, trying to get someone fired because you don't like them sort of scenario. In this case, you would be killed. And so he says, so this is what we're going to do. And if you look at the first few passages, they keep repeating this out to explain. And I think it's really funny because it's, you can tell it's like a legal thing. because they list out all the instruments that are played. And you're like, oh, these people are so didactic. Anyways, and so the herald proclaimed aloud, "You are commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, that when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music," they must be Scottish, "you are to fall down and worship the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace. Therefore, as soon as all the peoples heard the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, all the peoples, nations, and languages fell down and worshiped the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up." All right, so this is the scenario, right? So you have the whole kingdom, you hear this big noise, and everyone's like, okay, quick, we got to turn to the giant golden statue and bow before it. And it's probably very much a ritualistic kind of thing at some point. Like, I'm sure a lot of people did not think, oh, praise great Nebuchadnezzar. I'm sure a lot of it was just going through the motions. But, you know, it's easy to say, well, as long as I go through the motions, it's okay, right? I mean, my heart's not into it. I'm not really worshiping. I'm just going through the action. Now, I don't know about you, but I probably make those compromises in my own spiritual life and my relationship with God all the time, where I tell myself, it's okay. It's not really, you know, dishonoring God. It's, how else would I live? You know, that's the society that we're in now. We just have to accept it. We make those compromises all the time. My point about that is, it means, do you know where your kingdom identity really is? Do you know where your heart really lies? So what happens is, then these people who don't like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego said, "There are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, pay no attention to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up." In other words, these people are like, ha-ha, tattletale, and then now we're going to get them in trouble and get thrown in the fire. Okay, so clearly, in this case, there is a very clearly laid out punishment. There is clearly a laid out action that leads to that punishment. And then there's clearly three guys who look at all this and still choose not to. All right, and I love this part because we come to this scene where they are talking to each other. So Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered, as he brings them in, answered the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If this be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up." So much conviction, so much strength, so much courage to say that. But when you read it, it's like, is that courage? It's almost like it's who we are. We can't give it. In fact, O king, and they still address him, they still know he's king. You just say, but we're not serving your gods. Our God could save and deliver us. Now, for us, you might think, oh, yeah, well, this is different for them somehow. No, yeah, it was different. It was like a million times worse. They're living in complete exile in a completely different place. They have a high-paying, powerful job which offers them benefits. They're living in this kind of place. So they're in a foreign place. They have great jobs. There's a lot at risk. And they never lose sight of the fact that their God is the God above all. Now, these are people, they're not meeting every week for church. They don't have this encouraging message. They don't have gathering for worship. Back then, they used to go to the temple. They can't go to the temple anymore. The only place they can pray is in their rooms. And when they first started doing that, they were like, we don't even know how to pray. We used to have to go to the temple. Only the priest could pray. Now we stand there and we say, okay, well, God, I'm going to try to talk to you because I know you're God above all gods. My kingdom is still with you even though I live in exile. That is incredible. And then the way they respond is, and even if not, and even we get thrown into the fire, what? We will not worship your gods. I don't know about you, but I don't have that kind of backbone. One of the things that most recently happened in our school, my son's school, is thinking about going to two sites. So they're going to two sites, and they're going to split reception in year one. So that means I have to drop Alex off at one place and then walk like 10 minutes down to another school and drop off drop off Oscar. Now, actually, this does not bother me. I don't care that much. It's fine. It's probably good. After my over 40 health check, I should probably do a little bit more walking anyways. So there are some people in the school who are really angry, really upset about this. And they kept coming to me, Bert, we're getting a petition together. Will you sign the petition and say that you're against it? And I was like, oh, I'm actually okay with it. I don't think it's a big deal. Well, you know, oh, please, you know, and they just go on. And you're like, okay, I really want to go home now. And so then they kept asking. And then I said, okay, well, maybe if you bring it, I'll look at it, and then I'll see. And so I'm doing my best to avoid these people because I have no backbone and I'm completely spineless. So one of them, she finds me. She said, oh, Bert, you're here. Oh, they're signing the petition over there. You should go sign it. I said, oh, yeah, I'll, and I basically lie saying, oh, yeah, I'll go around and have a look, meaning like I'll go around and run home. And she said, oh, wait, actually, I've got one here. I'm like, oh, no. She pulls it out. And I read it, and I tell myself, well, actually, it's not that bad. And you know what? Even if I sign this, this is not going to stop the school from splitting. Nothing's going to happen. So I said, I just don't want to make any controversy, so I will just sign this and be done with it. I signed it. I'm confessing to you, because you can look at, Bert, you are absolutely spineless. How will you stand up for God if you cannot even stand up to a woman with a petition? Part of me is like, it wasn't worth standing up for and it was going to happen anyways. But again, those are the kind of delusions which make you realize, yeah, actually, where does my courage lie? I feel like I redeem myself because I immediately go tell the other people who are against it. And I say, oh yeah, I signed it. She said, what? How could you do that? I said, I have no backbone. I literally just caved in to pressure. She says, and I realized, we do the same thing all the time, don't we? Cave into pressure. And we realize, it's because we're not used to understanding who we really are, what kingdom we are really part of. It really shone a light on me. Do you know what kingdom I'm part of? I'm in the kingdom that says, I don't want anyone to be upset, and I will do everything I can to make sure everyone's okay and not angry. That's the kingdom I live in, which is not God's kingdom at all, because it's complete. Well, I will push truth slightly to the side and come back and get later and say, I will bring truth to you now after I've compromised myself in so many ways. You have to ask yourself, actually, where are the places where I'm compromising? In my beliefs, in my relationships, in how I live. We talk about wanting to have courage to stand for what's right, but actually we don't even know what to have courage for. We don't even know what issues to stand up for. And it's because we don't know the God that we worship. What I'm trying to point out is that we are living in exile. We live in a great nation. The UK is fantastic, actually. There are so many things afforded to us. There's things like the NHS. There's things like a political system that you may or may not agree with, but at least it offers some liberties. But at the same time, this culture and the way things run, it's counter to what we believe in. And one of the biggest things is, as Christians, we say, well, we have to be tolerant, and that is fine. It means understanding, loving, and accepting. But if you know what love is not enablement. It's not saying, whatever you want to do, you can do. Love is saying, I want to show you the right way to live, the best way to go forward. I know this, I read about this one mom who never got chocolate buttons when she was growing up. So when she had her own baby, she loves her baby so much, she gave her baby chocolate buttons all the time. Of course a baby's gonna love chocolate buttons. And the baby also became like 6 stone. It's like massive. He said, oh, but that's love. You just give in to what your child desires. No, that's not love. You're killing your child. It's dangerous. But in this society, it says, well, if you really love, you tolerate and you let people do whatever they want. But for us, we know as Christians, that's not actually what love is. When your values are there, locked in with God, you say, okay, look, maybe some of this goes against the culture that we're in. But one of the great things about this culture is that we should be allowed to have a voice, to speak up for things. In love, in patience, in understanding, not trolling people or forcing a point down someone's throat, but being patient, understanding, and learning how to communicate and how to share and all these things. When you study and you look at the book of Daniel, especially the first few chapters, you will understand what does it mean for us to be living in exile in this place. How do we live as Christians in a world that doesn't know him? To kind of summarize this, it says, courage is revealed in who you are, and who you are is revealed in how you live. For Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, what happens is they say, look, we have complete courage, and we'll stand up to you and say, throw us in the fire, because if not, if we die, we die. If God, if not, God delivers us. It was who they were, and they knew from the very fact that they were still followers of God's kingdom. So what happens in this story is they get thrown in the fire. They get thrown in the fire, and the fire is so hot. It's so hot that even the people who get thrown in the fire get burned up. All right, that's how hot this fire was. And they're in there, and they're looking, and you can imagine, they're like, oh, yeah, I can't wait to watch them burn in agony for not bowing to... Why are there four people in there, and why are they walking around? So they look in, and he sees there's four people in there. Like, didn't we throw three people in? Yes, we only threw three people. Who's that last guy? What's he doing in there? And then they're like, what is going on? They say, just come out, come out. And they come back out, and they say, look, this is the deal. Nebuchadnezzar answered and said, well, he said, our God is taken. In other words, he really declared that, oh, look, that's gone. And at the end of this, when he pulls the people out, this is what Nebuchadnezzar says. Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and delivered his servants who trusted in him and set aside the king's command and yielded up their bodies rather than serve and worship any god except their own God. Therefore, I make a decree. Any people, nation, or language that speaks anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be torn limb from limb and their houses laid in ruins, for there is no other God who is able to rescue in this way. Then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon. Now, there's two things I want to point out here. Is one, what Nebuchadnezzar realizes about God. And the first thing is he says, these three people, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they trusted in their God so much so, they set aside the king's command and yielded up their bodies rather than serve and worship any god except their own God. Do you offer up yourself before God above anything else? Probably not, right? It's hard. We don't want to think about it. And you're like, I don't even know where to start. Completely before God is such a big term. What I want to say is, if you are saying, God, actually, I want to have who I am set in you, do you know how it starts? You just say, God, teach me. Show me what that means. See, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they didn't just show up one day and say, I'm ready to be thrown in the fire. No, actually, it all started when they first came into exile, and the very first moment they sat there, and they were offered the food, the best food on the king's table, basically trying to say, you know, you're going to learn. And Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego said, sorry, we're not eating this food because it's defiling to us. It wasn't just about the food. It was about their worship. It was about if we eat this food, we're saying that we follow their gods. But we don't want to eat that food because we want to follow our God. So from that very first step, they drew a line very clearly. And after that, God, I'm sure, continued to teach them so that when they got to this moment, they were ready. In other words, that faithful obedience, a step-by-step and saying, look, I continue to choose what God says in my heart to do and continue to follow and obey him is what opens the door for the next thing. Right. One more. Cain and Abel. Now, of course, when I say Cain and Abel, you're like, there's not much courage that happens in this passage, Bert. It kind of leads on from the last thing. Courage made in decisions. Courage is revealed in moments. In other words, your courage is made. It's created. You don't see it yet, but in the decisions you make. In your everyday decisions to do what's right, to obey God, to wake up, to read the Bible, to be slightly more compassionate, to say thank you, to show gratitude, to be generous. in all those little things, as you continue to do those small things, courage will then be revealed in moments. When suddenly you're asked to stand up for something. When you're suddenly challenged to do what's right. For Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, it was that, right? They took these small decisions. And then when it came to a big one, their courage was revealed. We look at Cain and Abel. Now, Cain and Abel is a heartbreaking story because it's Adam and Eve, after they kicked out of the garden, they had two boys. One was a shepherd, one was a farmer. And they, brothers. Then they both brought their sacrifices or their offerings to God. And it says Abel brought the best, the first, first fruit, the youngest lamb, and sacrificed it, and God was pleased. And it says Cain brought some of his crops, yielded some crops. The difference there is that Cain didn't bring his best. He didn't offer, really offer to God. It's almost like he withheld some. He withheld maybe the best for himself. Whereas Abel was like, I give everything to God. There is the supremacy of God over everything, whereas Cain was like, maybe it's not that great. After this happens and God is not pleased with Cain's offering, this is what God says to Cain. Why are you angry and why is your face fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin is crouching at the door. Its desire is for you, but you must rule over it. This passage should convict you strongly about living in sin or choosing the wrong thing. In those daily moments, there's this opportunity to say, look, sin wants to devour you, to eat you up, to take you, and to keep you in its clutches, in the fear, in the guilt, in the anxiety. But instead, it's saying, look, you have to subdue it. You have to know and be overcome it. This last thing is this thing, look, you have to have the courage to stand against sin in your own life. This is where it starts. Where in your own life you say, look, God, I am weak. I'm fighting this sin. I'm fighting this temptation. I'm fighting this part of my life. I'm fighting these relationships, fighting my laziness, my procrastination, my attitude, my bitterness, my fear, my worry, all of these things, God. But give me the courage to stand against it. Don't let it devour me. Don't let me get caught up in that sin. But let me live for you. And as you make those daily decisions, you'll find that when it comes to bigger opportunities, that courage will demonstrate and reveal itself. Courage. We hear a lot of these stories about courage. And even looking in the Bible today, we've seen some pictures of what it looks like. But when we look back, you say, look, if you lack courage, it's because you don't have anything worth defending. The greatest moments of courage, when you watch a movie and you see someone sacrifice their life for someone else, and you think, oh, that was amazing. That really inspires me. God wants you to have that same life for yourself, to be filled with that same kind of inspirational courage, but it just comes by being defending God himself. The question that I had is this. Do you know what you're living for? If you do, if you practice day to day committed to Christ, when the time comes to stand, the courage will be there. The strength will be there. But if you choose to deny Christ, if you choose to disappear into this world's value system, you will find yourself lost. Now, I know actually for a lot of us out here, we feel lost. We don't know what we're doing. We don't know where we're going next. Maybe it's a transition time. Maybe it's even in your own relationships. I don't know what I'm doing. If you figure out what it is that you're living for, that will make things a lot clearer. And for us, we know actually the best thing that is worth living for is Jesus, who is the perfect example of courage. He gives his own life up for us, going to the cross. And his goal, his focus, is always the glory of God. And that's the example for us. Actually, God, let my life and everything be for the glory of God above everything else. Let me look to you for that. And the greatest way he wants to bring glory is say, God, let me save humanity so that your name will be glorified. The glory of God. Now, let me share one story anyway. My wife and I have been having a lot of discussions lately about the future of our children's education. Now, if you do not have children, this does not apply to you. However, if you have gone through the education system, you will understand some of the fears and worries that your parents had to think about. What secondary school will my child go to? If he doesn't go to a good one, will he end up mixing around with hooligans and being in trouble and then turn to drugs and then one day be like work in like a chip shop? That is my nightmare. And so you send your kids from young ages to these tutorial programs to get a leg up over the non-hardworking other people. You move into areas, into a better school district so that you can have your children have a better education. And you worry about them constantly. And then you hear, and what makes it worse is you hear other people, other moms talking about it, about the school system, and you start freaking out. And you say, maybe if we save up, we can send them to boarding school. It'll be fine. They can go to boarding school. You have this worry. So my wife's been worrying about more because she's been talking to moms, and she sees people in our school putting their houses on sale. They're moving to Sutton because there are better schools there. Should we move? We can't move anymore. We've already put too much money in this house. We're stuck here. And I keep telling her, look, you just have to have faith. And I think when I tell her that, she's thinking, yes, I have faith that my son will work hard. I have faith that God will get him into a good school. And I said, what for? So that he can have a good job, so that his life can be better than what? Than others. But that's the thing. That's why most of you are in secondary education, right? Because your life wants to be better than others. I said to her, look, I've seen kids go through to great schools and turn out really bad. I've seen kids go to bad schools and turn out really good. Sure, maybe your percentages, Bert, you're saying that's skewed statistical analysis. Maybe your percentages might say, but look at these ones, they all stayed in church at least. I said, look, fan, I think the most important thing that you have to be praying for is, can my son, my sons, God, can you do everything you can to help them glorify you in their life? And if that is the case, you train them the best that they can. And if that's the case, then you put them in the school that will train them the best for that. Now, that is hard. You know why that's hard? Because in Chinese culture and understanding, the part of us that makes us us means that they have to at least try to be a doctor at least for a little bit. Okay? Unless you're really Chinese, then it's you have to be a doctor no matter what. But if you're just like BBC, you should at least try to be a doctor. See, maybe. Okay. And accountant, lawyer, engineer. Those are our lists. But when you put it into the glory of God's perspective, you say, actually, you know what, God? We know all those jobs. You talk to them. No one's happy. They don't like their places. Yeah, we want to keep them in those places. You say, well, God, actually, I want everything for the glory because I know if he's a doctor, he could glorify you. But if I force me a doctor, maybe he won't glorify you. Isn't that much worse? God, if he just works at McDonald's for his whole life, will I be ashamed of him? Not if he's glorifying you in every way. And it changes the way you pray. It changes the way you look at the world. And it all comes back to this thing is, God, your sovereignty above everything else. And everything falls into place from there. Because you think about it. If you're praying, actually, God, I want my child to grow in these kingdom values, to be someone full of courage, full of love, full of peace, full of grace, someone who can share your love, either by words or by writing or by music or whatever. God, you use them for that. And if you want them to become some multi-trillionaire, God, then you better have trained them to glorify you. Because that money could just be a snare. And they could cut themselves off from us as a family as well. God, your glory in my child's life. I share that story with you because I want you to start thinking about how to pray for yourself, for the people around you. God, how can your glory be manifested through me? God, show me what it means for my life to glorify you. And as you start walking in that way, you'll discover the courage that you never even knew you had. Shall we pray? God, we thank you and we praise you and we lift your name up above every other name. You are glorious and magnificent. You are honorable and true. You are King of kings and Lord of lords, and who can compare to you? And we talk about you like you're not even here in this room. And even in my message, I speak about you like you're somewhere distant, and yet you are here, and you are ever present, and your spirit dwells in us. And we speak about you as if you are a foreign God. But God, you are God of us. We are your kingdom people. You are our leader, even though we live in this exile. But let's not walk in fear or in timidity, but in the courage to demonstrate that your truth and your life is greater than anything else. And we demonstrate that in the way we live, in our interactions, in our love. So Lord, will you convict us of our sin now, of where we've gone wrong, of the ways that we have put you aside? And then as we come to the communion table, Lord, will you cleanse us again and restore us and say that we are your, filled with your blood, and part of your body, and we belong to you. We thank you in Jesus' name.